Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
It's Monday, October 15, 2001. My name is Jeff Steinberg. Welcome to the LaRouche Connection. As the result of the now ongoing bombing campaign and perhaps follow-on military options against Osama bin Laden's organization and the Taliban inside Afghanistan, there is a growing danger that a generalized world war or some kind of serious religious warfare may break out at any moment, not as the direct result of the actions taking place in Afghanistan, but as the result of what has been referred to for many years as the breakaway ally scenario. Specifically, what we're talking about is the danger under the present circumstances of a mad regime inside Israel, with the Sharon government being one factor, but senior officials within the Israeli Defense Force and radicalized fundamentalist settlers movements even a bigger factor in the potential for Israel to launch some kind of major provocation within the Middle East region that, under the fragile circumstances represented by the actions in Afghanistan, could trigger a generalized war. Now, following the events of September 11th, it became almost a foregone conclusion that some kind of military operations would be launched against Afghanistan and against the bin Laden apparatus. This was a matter that Lyndon LaRouche cautioned against during the early moments of the September 11th events, when many of you may recall he was being interviewed live on a Salt Lake City radio show by host Jack Stockwell. And as soon as the word came out of the attacks against the World Trade Center and against the Pentagon, LaRouche cautioned that some people in Washington would jump to conclusions and attempt to put the entire blame for the attack on Osama bin Laden, thus creating a kind of logic for military operations over there in Afghanistan. Now, it may very well be that elements of the bin Laden apparatus were involved in a direct way as the on-the-ground forces responsible for the September 11th attacks. However, LaRouche has cautioned since that opening day and right up through to the present moment that there is a much bigger factor involved here, which constitutes an enemy within here in the United States. The sophistication of the September 11th attacks could not have occurred without one of two additional factors being in play. Either there are high-level rogue elements within the United States and more broadly within the Anglo-American intelligence apparatus, by which we talk about networks involved in Britain, Canada, and the United States, who were directly involved in facilitating the takedown of security screens that would have, under normal circumstances, prevented such an attack from occurring. If there were such high-level complicits in the September 11th attacks, then we're dealing with a phenomenon that must be understood as a cold coup attempt against the government of the United States, against our constitutional system, and it may very well represent a threat directly to the life of President Bush and other senior government officials. The second potential form of internal factor could involve the fact that our security structures themselves have been so denigrated and so taken down that we were unable to detect and preempt an operation of the scale of September 11th, even though major elements of it were staging inside the United States for months and perhaps years before the events actually occurred. So the complete picture, regardless of whether there was an Al-Qaeda involvement in the events of September 11th, does not lie exclusively with capabilities on the ground in Afghanistan or even in the other centers of bin Laden and related Afghanzi activity around the world. And of course, it's crucial to remember that the entire Afghanzi terrorist infrastructure, was created from the period of 1979 through 1990, when the U.S., British, and Israeli intelligence and military services ran a decade-long war to drive the Soviet Red Army out of Afghanistan and created an irregular warfare capability of tens of thousands of nominally Islamic recruits who were deployed, armed, trained in Afghanistan, and were then basically set loose on the world as a new form of terrorism. So under any circumstances, we're dealing with a much more complex phenomenon. Now, where does this bring us to the breakaway allied danger presently represented by Israel in the Middle East? Well, the fact of the matter is that there are some people in the United States, in Britain, and elsewhere who wish to use the events of September 11th to trigger what Samuel Huntington has called the clash of civilizations, a war, as he put it, between the West and the rest, particularly the nations of the West fighting against the 1.2 billion Muslims living in every part of this planet today. There are people inside the national security structures of the Bush administration, typified by Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Richard Perle, who is the chairman of the Defense Policy Board, and many other people in and around the Department of Defense who are pushing for this clash of civilizations. The specific form that that pressure is taking is for the United States to launch military operations against Iraq, either simultaneous with the operations in Afghanistan or immediately after the Afghanistan operations are completed. Now, one thing is perfectly clear. It's been clear to LaRouche all along, and it appears that some people in and around the Bush administration are also clear on this issue. If you launch a follow-on attack against Iraq or against any other target in the Arab or Islamic world, then you are very likely to trigger this full-scale clash of civilizations. And there are people who would like nothing better than to see this planet go up in flames as the result of such an action. Now, so far, the Bush administration, President Bush, Secretary of State Powell, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, appear to have rejected the pleadings from Wolfowitz and Perle and others for this war against Iraq and this broad-based clash of civilizations. However, there represents a second danger that the same outcome can result if there is not massive pressure placed on the present Israeli government, and particularly the Israeli military, to stand down and not carry out a provocation on their own that would create the same effect. Now, on October 12th, Lyndon LaRouche issued a campaign statement, which was a warning against the possibility of this clash of civilizations crowd, the Huntingtons, the Brzezinskis, the Richard Perles, encouraging their allies inside Israel, particularly within the Israeli Defense Forces, to stage a provocation in the Middle East against Iraq, perhaps a major military incursion into the Palestinian territories, perhaps an assassination of Yasser Arafat, any one of which of these things would be sure to trigger a major Middle East conflagration, and the entire Islamic world would go up in flames. Every moderate Arab government in the Persian Gulf and in the Middle East would be overthrown in a matter of days or weeks at the most, and we would be fully in the kind of clash of civilizations that LaRouche has been warning about for some time. So we have the danger of President Bush succumbing to pressure, blackmail from the Israeli lobby in the United States, including the neoconservative Israeli lobby elements within the Pentagon and elsewhere in his own administration. Then we have the second danger of an Israeli breakaway ally operation to, on its own, launch a provocation that forces the United States into combat under terms which right now we are very much trying to avoid, even as the moves are being made against bin Laden and the Taliban inside Afghanistan. So we are, as of the launching of the bombing raids a little bit over a week ago, on an extremely slippery slope in which the slightest error, the slightest capitulation to these pressures on the part of the Bush administration brings on the full-scale clash of civilizations. And if that occurs, then this nation and the entire planet is facing a dark age that will take one to more generations to get our way out of. Now, those people in London, on Wall Street, and elsewhere who are advocating this clash of civilizations have an underlying motive which must be constantly borne in mind in order to understand who's pushing this idea and just where the danger is coming from. As Lyndon LaRouche has emphasized repeatedly for some time, we are now in the final phases of collapse of the present international monetary and financial system. This global monetary system is bankrupt beyond repair, and the only thing that can save us from a full-scale planetary economic dark age in which the prospects of war, of clash of civilizations, would be greatly heightened is a fundamental reorganization of the entire international monetary and financial system along the lines of what LaRouche has called for in his new Bretton Woods proposal, which begins with the idea that the massive volume of international debt today is uncollectible, is in most cases illegitimate, and has to be completely written off as the first step in a worldwide bankruptcy reorganization, the way a large industrial concern would be put through bankruptcy reorganization if it had financial problems but was still fundamentally a sound, productive entity. Secondly, LaRouche has emphasized that we must use the opportunity of such a new monetary system to launch a series of great economic projects to overcome the physical economic breakdown process that has followed from the monetary crises, particularly those that we've seen since the 1997 to 1998 period. At the center of LaRouche's proposals for such great projects is the Eurasian Land Bridge, the idea of constructing development corridors stretching from Western Europe across Russia, down into South Asia, into the Near East, and all the way into the Pacific Far East through China, Japan, and the Korean Peninsula. These projects would represent the real scientific and technological driver for a world economic recovery. And LaRouche's ideas have been widely accepted among leading political circles in Russia, in India, in China, and in many other nations of the world. There are factions in the United States that know that LaRouche is right on this issue, even though they may not yet be willing to come out and say so publicly. So if you look at the vector of the clash of civilizations, the major concentration area for this provocation is the heart of Eurasia. The Middle East threat represents a broader threat to explode the entire Islamic world, stretching from the Near East all the way into the far corners of Asia and other parts of the globe. The actions that are now ongoing in Afghanistan, if they are not handled properly, in the most effective way, with a continuous emphasis that this is not a war against Islam, is not a clash of civilizations, could have the effect of triggering a new great game of the kind that the British were notorious for playing as a key to their imperial policies in the late 19th and 20th centuries. So the world is on the verge of either a great breakthrough towards solving these problems that have been ignored and allowed to get worse and worse for the last 30 years, or we are on the verge of exactly the dark age clash of civilizations that LaRouche has been warning about for many, many years and with increasing intensity in recent weeks, particularly since September 11th. The solution to the clash of civilizations has been laid out by LaRouche, has been laid out, in fact, also by the current Pope John Paul II, in the call for an ecumenical dialogue of civilizations. Such an ecumenical dialogue among the great religions of the world would not be an abstract philosophical discussion, but would go to the heart of the issue of improving the conditions of life of citizens of every nation of this planet, and ending the clash of civilizations in the only way possible, by a new kind of cultural and economic renaissance planet-wide that would remove the underlying causes of the crisis, the terrorism, and the events that threaten right now to bring us into a dark age. So the breakaway ally threat represented by Israel at this moment as we speak is one of the most critical things to bear in mind. The American media, led by CNN and Fox TV in particular, have tunnel visioned the American people, who are already addicted for the most part to this kind of media brainwashing, into following the details, the ins and outs of Osama bin Laden, of the Afghanistan campaign. But while people are being drawn into focusing on that, as LaRouche has emphasized, the far greater danger today centers out of the Middle East, with the Israeli Defense Force leadership wishing to provoke a war with Iraq, a military atrocity against the Palestinians. And were this to occur, as I say, we would be facing something more horrific than World War as we've known it in the 20th century. So on that note, I call all of your attention to LaRouche's writings on this subject, his warnings that have gone out to policymakers in Washington and in capitals around the world. For the LaRouche Connection, this is Jeff Steinberg. Now let's turn in more depth to the question of the Eurasian land group. The bulk of the remainder of this week's edition of the LaRouche Connection will feature the conclusion of Helga Zepp LaRouche's speech on the subject of the Eurasian land group, which was delivered at the Labor Day 2001 conference of the Schiller Institute that took place in Northern Virginia.
This is a storyteller, a professional storyteller. His name is Abu Shadi, and he tells stories about the Silk Road. This is a place in Damascus, and he makes many jokes, so people have a very good time. He's being interviewed here, and he said, we Arabs are very proud of the Silk Road because this was a great epoch with freedom for the mind and tremendous wealth for the people, and as it was, it should become again. So he says, what is the message of the Silk Road today? And he says, for me as a storyteller, it's very clear. The people from many cultures and nations must learn to listen to each other and exercise tolerance. That is the spirit of the Silk Road. Now, at our Bad Schwalbach conference, the Egyptian representative said that the government of Egypt just had conducted a conference in Port Said on the Eurasian land bridge, defining the role of Egypt as the link between Eurasia and Africa, that Egypt is aware of the fact that this will lead to a total increase in global trade, some of which will go through Egypt, especially through the Suez Canal, and it will enhance Egypt's position as a link between Africa and Asia. And, you know, that Egypt is very proud not only of its ancient culture, but also to be the only Afro-Asian country. Now, Russia, on the other side, is the only Eurasian country, where part of it is in Europe, representing European culture, and part of it is in Asia. Now, the Egyptian representative pointed out that the new railway system will go to Sudan. Next slide. Which is presently on a different gauge system, which obviously was built, which was built by the British, so that the Egyptian railway system and the Sudanese would not go together. The Egyptian speaker said Sudan could become a hub to Central Africa, and from there go across the Great Desert to Dakar. Another connection from Sudan to Chad, to Congo, to Ethiopia, Eritrea, another one to Uganda and Cape Town. And from Egypt, another line to Libya and North Africa. Now, this is our program, how Africa should be linked to the Eurasian land bridge. And there is no way how Africa can come out of its present terrible crisis without such a program. So people who are concerned about Africa, they must learn and study the Eurasian land bridge. Another speaker, Professor Rumiko from Moscow, talked about the necessity of Russia to define its mission as a new science driver program for Russia, which would revitalize the enormous reservoir of Russian scientists. He said, what we need is the most intensive forms of technological and social and cultural evolution, and where we can study this the best is how does this develop under the most extreme conditions of life, such as in the Arctic north of Russia. If you remember the north of Russia, there is presently a gigantic migration, a real flight of the population from the Russian northern territories, which still suffer from the reform program. And it is urgent to develop new ways of mastering life under these extreme northern conditions. Professor Gromyko pointed out the connection between space flight and life under such very difficult conditions. And he pointed out that both go against the monetarist policies. And he cited the famous Russian scientist and physical economist and co-thinker of LaRouche in Russia, Pobis Kuznetsov, who once told the Politburo of the Central Committee of the KPDSU that there is no point in taking paper money on a space flight because it has no life support function on a space flight, which I think is an interesting observation. Now, Professor Gromyko said that Russia can be characterized as a northern civilization, and that it is impossible to think of a vision for Russia without a new program to promote life under the conditions of the far north. A very important feature is the promotion of life above the Arctic Circle, and there, again, the idea of the development corridors as proposed by LaRouche is very important, the building of new science cities which concentrate on teaching and training of young people, scientists, and so forth. Also important in this is the Vernadsky idea of the development of new materials and energy productions in order to provide conditions for high population density in these areas. Next slide. Now, this is the north of Russia. As you can see, the Eurasian land bridge. Since we are here already, we could easily go through the Bering Strait into Alaska, Canada, the United States, and beyond. I should just note that the speeches of the Bad Schwalbach conference, which was an assembly of some of the most important representatives of the institutions of these countries which do this land bridge program, again went out in all of Eurasia and basically in Russia. That led then to the invitation of Lin in June to the hearing in the Duma Economic Commission, where the Duma had basically invited Lin to speak on the issue of how can Russia protect itself from the consequences of the global financial crisis and what measures should Russia take for its defense, which Lin elaborated, the new Bretton Woods principles. And, you know, you remember that Tatiana Koryagina in that context had made her famous prediction about the coming dollar crash, and she was very confident that this would happen. And we now know that, you know, basically that the issuing of the gold coin in Russia, the Sherbonets, and the idea of having a gold ruble is what gave her this certainty that the development was going on, was going to happen in this way. Now, gold is playing a very important role, not only in Russia, but also the other CIS countries, the republics of the former Soviet Union, are moving in this direction, but also in Asia and in the Middle East, gold already plays a very important role as a savings device and people, you know, have a lot of their savings in gold. Now, next slide. Therefore, if you think about all of this, it is a matter of life and death for the United States to link up with this beautiful development, which is not only a Eurasian land bridge, but as you can see, is meant to be a global reconstruction program, including every part of the world, Africa, Latin America, Australia. Now, obviously, this means that we have to change the economic thinking of the last 30 years of post-industrial decay. And we have to rebuild the agro-industrial base of the United States. We have to rebuild the infrastructure. I think we have to invest something like several trillion dollars in infrastructure in the United States alone to, you know, get safe roads and railways and so forth. We have to build new cities. I mean, you saw some of the areas in Eurasia are absolutely not populated, but there are such areas in the United States. We have to build new farms, factories, education, health systems, and we have to get a mobilization to get the U.S. functioning again as an industrial power. And it can be done, as Lynn pointed to FDR's example, and we will do it with Lynn today. Special emphasis has to be on rapidly rebuilding the machine tool sector, the small, medium-sized, high-technology firms in the United States, which are the foundation of any modern economy, because it is there where the transformation of scientific and technological discoveries into the higher productivity of the production process occurs. America must return to the American system. The United States must resume its role as a primary science and technology driver for the world economy. The U.S. should take a leading role in developing and promoting advanced technologies, for example, for greening the world's desert, large-scale desalinization of seawater, which is urgently needed in North Africa, the Middle East, but also Southern California.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
We have to go back to the idea of large infrastructure programs, such as in the tradition of the Tennessee Valley Authority. China is in the middle of building the Three Gorges Dam, and an even larger project is right now under negotiation, the famous Brahmaputra River Project, which takes the water, which is now causing tremendous floods in Bangladesh and elsewhere, which the river which comes down from Tibet into this corner where Tibet, Burma, and the Assam province of India come together, where there is a gigantic drop, a big waterfall, where gigantic masses of water come down, and the idea is to build a tunnel besides the river as a hydroelectric generator of electricity. This is a project bigger than the Three Gorges Dam, and it is in an area where there is no energy production whatsoever, so it will transform the whole area, and this is being negotiated between India and China right now. Now, we have to revive in the United States the U.S. Navapa project, which would bring down water from northern Canada through into the western United States into Mexico, which would eliminate the severe water shortages in the southwest of the United States and create huge amounts of electric power. The Navapa project should be integrated with the corridors running down from the Bering Strait to Latin America. If we do this, you will have a new era of prosperity and full employment for all the people in the United States and in the Americas. LaRouche's OASIS plan is the only hope for the Middle East. The U.S. should promote joint projects with several nations of the Eurasian land bridge in Africa, in Latin America, and this way create the largest markets for exports where alone in the area of the strategic triangle, Russia, India, China, and Southeast Asia, you have 3 billion people. Now imagine how the world will change with corridors, hundreds and thousands of new cities, transformation of the deserts into land used for agriculture. You will have forests, gardens. There will be a gigantic demand for capital goods coming from the United States. The question of who pays, Lynn answered it yesterday already. You will have gigantic markets with increased buying power of ever richer clients. It is good old economic scientific thinking to go this way. So we have to undo the gigantic primitive accumulation which has occurred in the last decade. In Africa, in two generations, we can turn it into a continent on the same living standard as the United States or Europe. And this would be a much better compensation than any sum of money for slavery and colonialism, money which is going to be worthless in any case. So if the people of the United States want to come out of the depression and have jobs, education for their kids, and health care, the Eurasian land bridge is the only way to go. But let's look at the question of what foreign policy should be and what should be the relations to other countries in a world in the world and what it should be based on. Think back to the founding fathers and especially John Quincy Adams, who had the idea of having a community of principle of sovereign nation states who all work together for the common good and who defined the common progress as the joint goal of mankind. Next slide. Now, one of my favorite friends, Nicolaus of Cus, whose 600th birthday we celebrate this year, had actually many of the ideas which went into the American Constitution of inalienable rights for everybody. So he had the idea of concordancia, that peace is only possible in the macrocosm, the world at large, if all microcosms, meaning all nations, develop their maximum potential. Each microcosm, each nation, must understand it at itself best self-interest that the other one develops in the best possible way and vice versa. But what about all these different cultures, the neo-isolationist complaints? I don't understand them. They are strange. Why should I put my future on something I don't understand? Or another version, I don't control. And there you can see a little imperialist thinking sneaking through here. Nicolaus von Kuhs said, different nations can understand each other because each of them have scientists, universal principles, and which are true in each culture and each language. Each have doctors, poets, philosophers, and so forth, who all have universal principles, and therefore they can talk to each other, and they're true for all. In De Pace Fide, about peace in faith, one of his writings, Nicolaus says, talks about an ecumenical basis for peace. He has a dialogue in which representatives of 17 nations and religions come to God. And they say, we are all fighting each other in terrible wars, supposedly because we all do it in your name. How can you help us? And then God says, well, he talked to the different religious representatives, not as religious representatives, but as philosophers. He said, you are men of wisdom, and you can understand that the error which people make is that they mistake the word of the prophet for the word of God. And that's how these differences come into being, and that's what causes religious wars. also people mistake the difference in custom as truth. Just because people have a different tradition and a different custom doesn't mean, you know, that the custom is truth, but what you have to think is the one of mankind before the many of the different nations. Nicolaus taught people the thinking of the coincidence of opposites, that unity exists before the differentiation, that you have to think from above, you have to think from mankind first and then go into the unfolding of the difference. This requires not an Aristotelian method of contradiction, the famous sentence by Aristotle where he says, if two things are opposite, they can't be the same at the same time. Now, Nicolaus says this is ridiculous because if you only run around for contradictions, you know, I mean, you don't understand anything. But Nicolaus says you have to think like being on a very high tower, where you look down and you see the guy who's looking for contradictions in the field, and you see the searcher, the searched, and the process of the searching, which means you have a completely different understanding of the process of finding the truth than the guy who's running around blindly back and forth. Now, Nicolaus said that if we apply the coincidence thinking to the relation to other nations, we start from the uniqueness and universality of mankind as primary, and then have the otherness and the differentiation which follows. If we speak to that which is universal in the other, we can find easy ways of understanding each other. Nicolaus speaks of the sweetness of truth, that the more you know it, the more your appetite for it grows. If you know the beauty of another culture, you will start to love it. If you start to study and understand Chinese painting, poetry, and Florentine art of the 15th century, then you see that indeed each of these have something very lovable. Next slide. Here you have the Alhambra, the famous palace city of the Nasirite dynasty in Granada, one of the most famous examples of Islamic art. This was a high point in Islamic culture on the Iberian Peninsula in the 14th century, and it was built at the same time as the cathedrals in Cologne, Milan, Strasbourg, and the Signoria in Florence. This first picture is the very impressive gallery of fine columns which surrounded the yard of the famous Lion's Palace. Next. This is a view from the inside of the surrounding wall of the Alhambra, which included about 30 different towers which belonged to different palaces and had also so-called palace towers, which we have here, a two-story building with many side rooms. Next. This is the Comores Palace, with a magnificent inner yard. Along one side you have the living quarters of the palace, and at the top and the bottom public reception and administration halls. This was the built in around 1400, at the same time when the Italian Florentine Renaissance really started to develop. Next. Here you have an elegant garden of the palace of the Generalife, with a long patio around a water fountain with a very rich water technique, which underlines the special symbolic meaning of water in Islamic culture. So the dialogue of cultures is obviously a superior idea to the barbaric conception of Samuel Huntington of the clash of civilization. Lin and the Schiller Institute promoted this idea in many, many seminars, helping the process of communication among the countries of the Eurasian land bridge. Because if you look at Confucius, Mencius, Chu Xi, you see that there are very similar ideas like in Christianity, in Nicolaus of Cus, Leibniz, or between the poets of the different countries, Pushkin, Schiller, there are very similar ideas. Now, what should a nation do that did not produce some of these poets, artists, on that level? Or what should do a nation which has a lot of them? Obviously, this is not a question of being chintzy and keep what you produced for yourself, but great composers, thinkers, poets are not the national property, but they belong to all of mankind. In the famous Abbasid dynasty in the 7th and 8th century, the caliphs Al-Mansur and Al-Ma'mun sent emissaries to Egypt, Italy, Spain, and Greece to bring back all the discoveries and cultural goods. And they weighed the discoveries in gold. And out of this, they made a new Renaissance. And then the collaboration between Al-Ma'mun and Charlemagne helped Europe to come out of the Dark Age at the time. So a small nation, which did not have its own special cultural tradition, or any nation, should just take it all. Take whatever has been produced by universal history up to this point and make it your own. Mankind has come to a point where we are all sitting in one boat. The crisis is so fundamental that we have to take the best of all cultures, of all of universal history, restudy and revive it, and out of this make a new renaissance. And why not take the best from other cultures and make it our own? Because it's the very nature of creativity, of which great art is only one expression, that it is generous, that it is not austere. Classical beauty is universal. What is great and truthful in one culture can be easily understood in another one. Next video. Now this Chinese boy for sure understood the spirit of the European composer whose piece he played. Lin said repeatedly, we would only come out of this crisis if a sufficient number of people developed to become leaders on the level of the sublime. Schiller gave us a very rigorous definition of what the sublime is. Sublime is a situation or a person where our sensuous nature is physically threatened and in danger to go under, but where our reason proves to be superior. As sensuous beings, we have two drives, one instinct for survival and secondly a drive for cognition. As sensuous beings, we feel a dual dependency, first when there is danger to our life and secondly when something prevents us from having an adequate understanding to comprehend reality as it is. Reason allows us to go beyond the dual dependency in physical terms because we are not afraid of the danger, in theory because we can think beyond what we presently know. We can come up with a deeper level of understanding. Schiller says, in the theoretical sublime, we experience an increase in cognition. It is a challenge to our power of imagination to go beyond previously existing levels of cognition. Pain or fear is an alarm signal for our instinct of survival. A danger where our mind knows resistance is in vain leads to fear. But the inner freedom of the mind is it from which the sublime comes. Schiller says the condition is very rare and therefore it requires an elevation of the human nature. This calmness of inner freedom can only come from an inner or moral security. The security cannot relate to our existence, but it must be in respect to the principles we believe in. So the theoretical sublime is what is required to imagine the future of mankind, to feel the pain of what happens to the world and future generations if we do not correct the present course, of what will happen to the world if we do not act. Contrary to the propaganda, the United States is not in physical danger from any of these countries of the Eurasian land bridge. What is therefore required is not what Schiller would call the practical sublime, because your physical existence is not in danger in this way, even so from a larger standpoint, if they have a dark age, it is. What is required is especially the theoretical sublime. What is challenged is your drive for imagination and for cognition. And what you have to do is just take the whole mankind, the whole world in your heart and be their parents. Be the ones who undo this terrible sickness of the world. And if we do this, I think we will look in the most beautiful future anybody can imagine. And that is a challenge to your imagination as well.
To round out this week's edition of the LaRouche Connection, we turn again to the Labor Day weekend Schiller Institute conference, and we bring you excerpts of an extensive dialogue that took place between Lyndon LaRouche and participants in the conference from the audience.
I was a college student, not going back. I've seen the intellectual wasteland. However, I do look at the Schiller Institute as an organization similar to, along the lines of something like the Franklin Institute or the American Philosophical Institute that he set up to look at such problems as how to develop new sciences and look at developing new ways of the human mind. And when I'm a full-time organizer with the Schiller Institute since the beginning of this summer. And one of the concepts that immediately jumped out at me is the question Vernadsky seemed to pose to us all. And much in the same way that a lot of good scientists pose paradoxes that future generations can look at and improve upon. He posed a question: how do we use our cognitive ability, the creativity of the human mind, to create a change in the biosphere, noticeably increasing the energy flux density and the relative population density? And this allows us to create new processes with which let man see the way the universe operates through his own mind. As the human race takes moves to develop the arid regions and increase the population of the inner areas of Eurasia and the vast northern colder regions of the tundra and Siberia and so forth, can we change the climate of the areas, making them more temperate and ideal for human life? To what degree do you see the human race being able to, in the next couple of decades, transform the surface of the Earth, building even mountains, rivers, creating weather conditions, and regulating heat and generally just the weather patterns over the face of the Earth. And how far would we go with this? Would there ever be a purpose or possibility of creating such things as man-made mountain ranges or thunderclouds?
Well,
thank you.
Well, much of this that you address as possibilities obviously exists as questions. One of the problems is in meteorology, we really don't know very much about it for various reasons. The question of Vinatsky is quite pertinent in all this, is a good example. Let me just repeat, I've said it before, so I'll say it as quickly as possible on this question. One of the key problems, and this problem of energy is also a problem. I had this discussion, again, several times in Moscow with people who were working in that area. That we have, as I've defined it, you have three kinds of universal physical principles in the area of physical, what we call normally physical relations. One, you have what they call the abiotic area. Abiotic processes experimentally have certain universal characteristics, which is what people generally think of when they talk about universal physical principles, is the abiotic domain. Now, some people who are not thinking clearly have tried to explain life and even human thought in terms of the so-called abiotic principles. That is, principles which you think about systems that are not living systems, and say that if something is living, as a living process, it must have been derived by means of principles which are peculiar to non-living processes. Not true. Secondly, and this is where Vinatsky made his contribution, if you study the biological processes, you discover that the behavior of man in his relationship to the biosphere is such that man does something that no animal can do inside the biosphere. That is to willfully change the characteristics of the biosphere. This change occurs only through the process of cognition. Vinatsky calls it noetic action, which is otherwise what I call cognition. He does not take into account the social side of the effective principal action of cognition in transforming the biosphere. He addresses only one thing, quite validly, is the relationship of a discovery by an individual discoverer to the practice of society on the abiotic and biosphere combined. The questions you ask pertain in part to these areas. We obviously know as a mission, and that we've addressed this repeatedly in terms of Central and North Asia, that we are capable of transforming the characteristics of these areas to make them habitable. For example, that Siberia has certain similarities in part to areas of Africa in terms of the mineral characteristics of the area, gold, so forth, so on, non-ferrous metals and whatnot. Much of the resources of North and Central Asia are not presently efficiently accessible to economic development or habitation because they are not properly developed. Can we develop these areas in degrees that we can actually make these natural resources exploitable economically by man? Can we increase the area of potential human habitation in these areas? Yes. Will this have changes, effects on the weather system? Obviously. If you change the way in which the water throughput is functioning through the atmosphere, you're going to change a lot of things. If you increase the amount of greenery on the soil, you're going to change a lot of things in terms of weather systems. All these things are known. Exactly what effects those will have in the extreme, we don't know. We have not done the experimental investigations that are required to do this. So that's the point. What we require, therefore, is a mission orientation based on a combination of things we do know with tasks which we think exist, but for which we do not have the solutions at present. So the way to approach this thing is not to make a list of things we can do in terms of as a final list, but to recognize the things we can and must do now, and then also, how do we provide the mechanisms of research, development, to be able to discover answers to these things. For example, light is extremely important as such for medicine. Not enough work is being done on what are called biophotonic reactions, things that pertain to living processes. We don't know enough about this. Not enough work has been done. We know the processes exist. We don't know enough about it to know how to solve. Why don't we do the research? We're not doing the research, or very little. So why don't we do more? Why don't we open up in universities and research laboratories and spend more effort on that? Why don't we save DC General Hospital and all other general hospitals, like public ones, which are the areas in which things pertaining to the medical application of these things are dealt with? As I said before, a general hospital, in the discussion we had yesterday, a general public hospital is a university. What does it do? It deals with all kinds of medical problems. That's why it's called general, a general hospital, with all the facilities, including the research facilities. It's a place where physicians are trained, where nurses are trained, where others are trained. It is a university. You need such universities. You couple these with all other kinds of research, clinics, and so forth. And this gives you the ability to make progress in knowledge of how living processes function. You start from man as a living process, and you work out from there.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.